Here we go. WTC back on the air for episode number 36. The 90s, the end of the century. This is the 90s part three. So we're once again going to talk about the 90s and kind of the final look back for this year, at least. Who knows when we'll do some more retro stuff, but final look back of the 90s for now. I am, of course, Mo, the Crown Prince of Charisma. And I am joined by you, Brett. Where are you?
Well, I'm not the Crown Prince of Charisma, obviously. Damn it, taken. No. I don't actually know what I am right now. I'll be magnificent for today.
All right. And we also got with us Keith. What are you?
I'm the Prince of Pies.
Prince of Pies. I like it. And Chris, what are you?
I outrank you all. I'm the King of Comics.
The King of Comics.
Oh,
all right.
There you go.
Excellent. So we got the King of Comics, the Prince of Pies, the Crown Prince of Charisma. Brett's just magnificent. That's boring, Brett. You're welcome.
You mean Mr. Magnificent? Sir Magnificent.
Yeah, I need some sort of alliteration.
The Magnificent Mage. I don't know. But anyways, the comic books, so we're going to, again, talk a little bit about the 90s, but as usual, we're going to open it up with our news. Now, you may not know this. Chris, have you ever heard of a site called Comicosity?
I have heard of a site called Comicosity.
Now, do you enjoy, I don't know what you would like about that site. I know that they have daily news. Were you aware of that, Chris?
Do they have daily news?
They do.
As in updated daily?
Yes, and it is my favorite part of Comicosity.
Do they also have reviews?
They have featured articles, Chris. Did you know that?
They have featured articles? No, I did not know that.
They do, which is my favorite part of Comicosity. Brett, were you aware that they had reviews? Have you heard of this site?
I was fairly sure that they did. I believe that they have some brilliant reviews, in fact.
Yes, the reviews are my favorite part of Comicosity. Keith, were you aware of Comicosity?
Those are the guys that have been stealing my thoughts and putting them on the internet for quite a long time now. They do put my name on it, though, which is nice.
What are you trying to say? Doing what?
Well, if you go to Comicosity and search me, Keith, you'll find a bunch of reviews for various comics. For example,
well, that's good.
Creator-owned Heroes that just went live this week.
That's good because, Keith, the previews are my favorite part of Comicosity. But seriously, folks, everybody, Comicosity, reviews, previews, reviews written by Brett and Keith, featured articles, daily news updates. You can't wait to get your news. You're getting it from Keith here every week. You're getting the highlights. Best daily source, the cleanest layout on all the internet, run by Comics Classiest Man, Aaron Long. Follow at Comicosity on Twitter. And, of course, you can follow Aaron at Juice005 as well for more updates there. We're very proud that we have Comicosity sponsoring our news section. So we're going to get to that right now. It is the weekly news with Cub Reporter K.
Well, we've got a crazy amount of TV and film news. Some rumor, some confirmed, some good, some bad. We have Avengers, Earth's Mightiest Heroes cartoon, canceled. Done and done. Who knows if they'll launch a new one right away with the success of the film, but they couldn't keep the cartoon going. We've got Michael Goldenberg, co-writer of the Green Lantern film, working on a Wonder Woman script. We've got Will Beall, writer of Gangster Squad and the remake or reboot of Lethal Weapon, working on Justice League. We've got rumors that Fox has registered the movie title, Days of Future Past, possibly the plot line of an upcoming X-Men movie. And we've got rumor that the May 2014 movie that we've mentioned a couple of times, it's still a secret, now theorized that it'll be announced at San Diego, could be an urban Black Panther movie. What else do we have? There's a 3.5-minute teaser trailer for Arrow coming from the CW this fall. Shows us a bit more of what that series will be about. And if you watch really closely near the end of that trailer, there's a flash of what appears to be Deathstroke's mask, not on a person, sitting on a rock or on some kind of post. So we may see some interesting DC faces show up in this show. What else are we seeing? San Diego Comic-Con exclusives are hitting the internet.
I was going to ask you, Keith, is there any comic book news that is related to comic books and not any other forms of media, movies and television? And
no.
No, actually. And that's the strange thing right now is we are still waiting on – if DC's pulling something in September, they still have not teased that. They still have not announced it. Usually the second Monday of the month is when DC does their solicits for what will be in previews that month. So the September ones, the September solicits, if they're on that schedule, are just days away, and we still haven't seen any announcements if they're pulling something. We could very well see see the solicits come out, and all it is this month, number 13, and all the theories go out the window of a zero month or an anything. Marvel also teasing some stuff on AVX, but keeping it pretty close to the vest. Something's happening in AVX future in September as well. So, strangely, no, I don't have a whole lot of comic news this week. So we are seeing San Diego Comic-Con exclusives coming out, and HeroClix has some very unique San Diego Comic-Con exclusives. They are doing HeroClix figures for Joss Whedon, Stan Lee, Harry Knowles from Ain't It Cool News, and Morgan Spurlock. I want me one of those Morgan Spurlock hero books.
Morgan Spurlock.
If I get one of those Morgan Spurlock hero clicks, I will commit to trying hero clicks for 30 days.
If I get one of those Morgan Spurlock ones, then it would be a good way to like stomp it and burn it in effigy.
I would like a Joel Schumacher hero clicks.
Mo, who would you like to get in a hero clicks?
What the hell's a hero clicks?
All right then.
Were those invented in the '70s? Then Mo might have heard of them.
And a shout out to our friends, the Flipping Boys, who announced this week that they will be closing down their podcasts. I'll miss you. Hello to Paul Hicks, who is now in the market for a new favorite podcast. I suggest us. And some sad news.
Doesn't get sadder than that.
Robert Washington III, co-creator and a writer of Static Shock, passed away of a heart attack at age 47. He didn't work much outside of Milestone, but that was quite sudden. And that's the news.
All right. The news had a lot of interesting tidbits on stuff that didn't have anything to do with comics. Well, I can't say that. They're still comic related, but, you know, giving your ass a hard time. That's not much investigative journalism. Get your ass out there. Get some stuff done there, Keith.
Well, I can start making stuff up, but,
hey,
we're not one of those sites.
You know
what?
We're not one of those sites. No, if you want stuff made up, I suggest Ain't It Cool. Anyways,
hey, I did some investigative journalism over this past week. I searched out Comic Canuck, and I found out the reason why he wanted to have that hardcover edition of Marvel vs. DC. So why don't we throw to my good friend Chris and Comic Canuck and why he wanted to do that?
So why do I want DC versus Marvel crossover? That's a good question. I think what I loved about it back in the 90s and other incarnations of that type of crossover over the years were just the fun that you had reading them. They were what comic books are. They are, it's just a fun drag 'em out, knock 'em out, holy terror of heroes going after each other from your favorite universes. And again, still connecting to Marvel versus DC, the most popular one they had, which eventually turned into, as we all know, the Amalgam Universe with Axis, the guy who could cross between universes and the corporate owned entity that I think, if I recall correctly, died very shortly after, maybe 2 years, 3 years after when they did that second run through on Amalgam, and all the comic book fans wanted to shoot themselves in the head. And I guess the thing that why do I want to get this in a hardcover and pay upwards of $40 to $60 of my well earned cash that could be going towards some really other awesome hardcovers like Clone Saga? Just kidding. Don't even get me started. But it's just one of those where I don't want to have all the issues. I don't want to have the paper trades. It's just a fun, like I said, when you've got Captain America versus Batman, you've got Superman versus the Hulk, Wonder Woman versus Storm, I think, if I remember correctly, which I probably don't. And you have these, now you have these two universes. They were all the classic heroes and the classic heroes that you grew up with your whole life. And you see them going at each other, and it's just a ton of fun. Now, my thinking on it is, we'll never see that type of crossover again in terms of classic hero versus classic hero, since DC completely abolished their whole history, and it would essentially be new DC heroes, new Superman versus, the Avengers or something crazy like that. It just wouldn't be right, and it wouldn't feel the same, because in the heart of comic book fans, they know that this just isn't the same. It's like New Coke versus Old Coke. Everyone still loves Old Coke. New Coke fizzled away quite quickly, and I'm thinking that the more comics that keep getting canceled by DC and the third wave and the fourth wave and the fifth wave and the sixth wave that come up in terms of titles to fill their new 52, they could fizzle just as fast as New Coke. Back, bringing it all back again, they're just fun series. And sometimes some of those crossovers I read, in high school and college. And weirdly enough, I'd have a bad day or things weren't going right. I'd just crack one of those open and I wouldn't find myself complaining about life or anything. Maybe down afterwards I'd complain a bit about what fight took place and why that person shouldn't have won or how cheesy this was or how bad the art was. But in that moment, it was something to just escape to. And I think that's what we all like about comics, is just to escape the everyday of things that happen. And there you go. That's why they will get my money. Again, those bastards.
All right, Mo, have you got some... I feel like you have some something to say to Chris.
I understand what he's saying. I really do. I really do. Comics should be fun. But the whole point of why this didn't work is because in order for comics to be fun, they also have to be good. If they're not good, they're not fun to read. And the problem was the quality was, anything's forgivable if it's good. The quality was not there for this.
Well, Keith, I think you also have found out something interesting about them. And Chris obviously has something to say as well.
Absolutely. I mean, looking back as I was preparing some thoughts for this week's topic of the rest of the 90s, I had not realized just how big the DC versus Marvel crossover was. DC versus Marvel number one was the number one comic of 1995, beating out Age of Apocalypse, beating out Spawn, which was at its near its peak, beating out all of these various Age of Apocalypse and the X-Men Omega. It was a huge, huge book. And then the following year, the number four was the number one book of the year, beating out Spawn, beating out the Superman Wedding.
I had even more reasons why it shouldn't have sucked.
I had no memory that it was that gigantic. And I took the time to take a glance at it this week, and it's terrible. It really is.
So that's exactly it. I mean, you had something here. Obviously, it's going to sell well. Even more reason for it not to blow. Chris, what do you think?
Well, I completely understand what Comic Canuck is talking about there. I personally tend to think that way as well. But at the same time, I don't have that much storage space. If I'm never going to reread it, why do I need it? True, historic crossover, also unreadable.
And now I'd like to point out, this is from Chris, the guy who has three copies of the comics that he likes.
Yeah. You know, the thing is
that... Wait a second. Hold on. Forget about the comic. How many DVDs do you currently own, Chris?
I'm probably around 50,000.
He doesn't have that much storage space.
I can't, keep DVD boxes anymore. I'm down to the discs.
Oh my God. All right, Brett, what your response to your buddy?
You know, I had to go back to the idea of that Keith brought up last week of when you do this, it does make it more concrete. And I think that is my biggest problem with his argument is that, you know, I actually don't want to remember it because I don't want it to be concrete in my mind. I know that it existed, but if I read it again, then I'm afraid that it will exist even more and I might actually remember it. That scares me. And there are better team-up books from Marvel and DC. You know, the Dark Side Galactus book, you know, some of the John Byrne stuff that came later on in that mess of crossover was really good. It's just a shame that the big one sucked.
All right, well, let's move on then to the fallout from that particular thing. DC and DC Universe and Marvel Universe screwed, and we got the Amalgam Universe. Keith, go.
The Amalgam Universe almost works. It comes so close to working. There's a John Byrne book. There's Dan Jurgens doing, I think he did the Metal Men. Byrne did the Cross of Wonder Woman Storm. They almost work, but the conceit of it just doesn't. I mean, if they had gone in with, you know, done in ones or as if it was a whole relaunch month or something with all number ones and introductories, it might have worked. But what they actually decided to do was to pretend that there had never been a Marvel and DC universe and that you were actually getting a random month of comics. They're all numbered number one, of course, but as if it was a random month and you were walking into the middle of ongoing serialized stories. It just didn't quite work. And there's a Dave Gibbons, Captain America and Superman. It should have worked. And they just don't hold water, unfortunately.
Yeah, Wade wrote that, Super Soldier.
Yeah, it should have been good. But there's something about the structure of, you know, trying to create stories that you're in the middle of that just, I don't know, it just didn't quite hold together for me. And they even came back to us about a year later and, that horse ain't dead.
Brad, what do you think?
Well, you know, I remember getting all the books and actually being fairly excited for them. But I also remember reading them around the same time as Keith did. And I just remember thinking, wow, some of these, not bad. But, you know, there was way more that weren't very good. It's probably like a third that was not bad and two thirds that just were really, really average. And again, it speaks to the epidemic of the crossover. Like they just pumped crossovers. It was like, hey, we're finally doing this and we're going to do it so big that it could almost never be done again because it's way too damn big here. And it's just like, you know, one or two little ones, maybe, but we like, The mass scale that they did it on was too much.
Chris, your thoughts?
I liked a lot of these books, but too many of them weren't thought out at all. I mean, Dark Claw, Batman and Wolverine, they didn't make any sense. They were taking characters with completely different motivations and just smushing them together because somebody feels it would be popular. It just didn't work. There were way too many titles that were forced. There wasn't enough quality books to recommend the line. I liked a couple of them, but really there was more Drek than there needed to be.
Come on, Lobo the Duck. Thorian of the New Asgods.
I'm looking here. I don't see a single book that was written by Dan Jurgens in this whole thing either, though he did have a hand in the miniseries itself. And that's it. I mean, it's not like they didn't they did get the best talent available to them. Maybe there wasn't that much of that talent available to DC and Marvel in this age. I mean, what's the worst book? Chris, give your best and worst amalgam book if you were to recall. Let's go through the room.
Oh, I'm having trouble remembering. I remember really hating Dark Claw. And there was Elektra.
Assassins.
I remember liking Assassins. But I also remember having a tough time figuring out who these characters were amalgams of.
Fail. That did happen a few times. You're right. That definitely did happen a few times.
Brett, yeah, it was Deathstroke, the Terminator, and Elektra, I believe.
Brett, what was your favorite and least favorite?
Well, oddly enough, I mean, I think that maybe Darkclaw might have been one of my favorites, but that doesn't actually mean very much. I don't really remember them very, very well. I think that when it comes down to it, there's so many, like, you know, Doctor Strange Fate or Bat Thing. I mean, they're written by competent writers mostly, but they're just not, they just don't interest me.
Yeah, I think Super Soldier might have been actually being the best one. I mean, it wasn't great, but at least it was competent. I don't know. You're trying to judge the best of crap. Well, it's still a piece of crap, isn't it? I mean, I tell you, I thought Generation Hex was awful. I did like Bruce Wayne, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. because I think Kerry Norton did the art. And I'll give a shout out to that talented artist. But yeah, I mean, it was awful. Keith, your pick for best and worst.
I'd probably go with Super Soldier or Amazon, which was the John Byrne one, for the art alone. Though I did the stories, I wasn't thrilled with. And except for Kerry Nord, I would probably put Bruce Wayne, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. as one of my bottom ones. Though I had forgotten, I think the Generation Hex, is that from the second wave or is that from the first wave?
It's from the first wave. It was awful.
Okay. Yeah, it was awful.
Yeah.
I'll say that one then. Yeah, that was terrible. There was eight. Can I pick seven, worst one?
Yeah, it's truly fair. Let's go back a little bit in time here, because Defiant Comics came about in, what, 1993, 1994?
93 to 95, I think.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about Defiant then, Brett. You jump right in, since you're the obvious expert. You gave the timeline.
Well, I think that Defiant was interesting because they were, I mean, Shooter had some success with Valiant. And the thing is that I think Shooter must be fairly hard to work with, but Shooter also has ideas.
You think?
A lot of ideas on how things should be run. And Defiant was his, you know, attempt at running another company. And the number one thing I remember about Defiant was Plasm, Warriors of Plasm. And I remember his maniacal idea of the Warriors of Plasm trading card set, which formed pages of the Zero issue, which, so you had to get all of the cards, put them into the card pages, the nine card pages, and then you were able to read the Zero issue. That may be the single most psychotic and worst idea for a special cover / issue, period.
You and I were trying to get some of those, Brett. I don't think we ever completed it, but I'm pretty sure if we had gotten it, Warriors of Plasm number one still wouldn't have made any sense.
I didn't actually hate Warriors of Plasm number one. I thought it was fair. But, you know, you're right. I mean, there's still no – and I don't even know how many issues it ran overall. I mean, maybe 13,
it was like,
whatever.
I don't even think it was like six.
Yeah, but it was their debut book. It was their book that – I mean, how did Shooter kind of get ousted from Valiant? Is anybody aware?
I think he might have left.
Yeah?
Because I think Shooter's a guy that tends to get bored a little easily.
And, you know, I mean, you had Defiant then. I mean, I know Warriors of Plasm. I certainly read it and thought he's doing – it's a Valiant book. It's just for a different publisher now. It's not – it's the style and the way he was doing it, the art and everything, the way it was, the production, the way it was put together, it was a valiant book. I mean, it wasn't like he was doing anything new. It seemed to have a new idea. It seemed doomed to fail from the start for me. Chris, what did you think?
I bought 4 copies on your guys' recommendation.
Well, we told you it would go up in value, but how many of those do you still have?
All of them.
Because any day now. Well,
yeah,
hang on.
That's my retirement fund.
Chris, we can use those as rewards for our upcoming Kickstarter to get Taysom to come on our show. Those could be the $10 rewards.
Absolutely. Yep. Get some of Chris's comics on Kickstarter.
Keith, Defiant, anything to say or anything on Shooter? I think you might have been trying to Google to see why you left.
I did. The answer is 13 issues. I assume not counting the zero. I did actually read the number zero. I think one of my customers at the store had a whole set. And, I was trying to get it myself. I know I got close. I started having enough to read, and I'm like, this is just awful. And I don't know how to get out of this now. But, cause I've made the commitment just trying to put a set together, but it's terrible. So, and it's valueless without making a set. Not that I would be retiring off my complete set of Warrior Supplies and zero it today. it made no sense, and it was just horrible. I don't think I read a single Defiant book after maybe the first month.
And you know, after the failure of Defiant, Shooter kept going. Brett, what did he do next?
He moved on to Broadway Comics, which basically was designed with the Broadway video, the Broadway home video company, where I don't even know what the overall plan. I know that he was planning on kind of porting a lot of the Defiant characters into Broadway, but Broadway had even less shelf life than Defiant. I mean, if Defiant got 2 years, Broadway got 1. You know, I mean, I think he was just throwing stuff at the wall and hoping that it stuck, and nothing stuck for that guy.
It seemed like at least with Broadway, he was trying to be innovative. Like I say, Warriors of Plasm and Defiant felt like Valiant retreads. Chris or Keith, either one of you two have anything to say about Broadway?
Yeah, actually, I would disagree with you. I thought Broadway had more superhero fare. I thought Defiant actually had some interesting titles. Not a lot of them worked, but Warriors of Plasm was definitely different. And I really liked Dark Dominion. And then I'm looking at some of the titles for Broadway Comics. And really closer to what he did at Valiant.
I think one of the things about the Broadway is that he was really trying to put a lot more strong women titles into effect. I think he was really kind of putting more of a focus on women, women writers, strong women characters, that kind of thing, which, you know, he's absolutely to be applauded for.
That's right. And I think especially should be applauded for the pinup book Babes of Broadway that really, I think, brought that into focus.
Actually, it's funny because I think that I was reading about that and a lot of it was, and all the blurbs are actually written by women within it, I believe. I could be wrong on that, but he was trying to, and I think the women were also like, I think they were supposed to be more normal human as opposed to Rob Liefeld human. And so I think that was where he was trying to go with that. Not saying that it was working.
You couldn't see their breasts and their ass in the same panel.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. Yeah, like a little more clothes, a little less, pouches.
You know, we need to do a whole extra episode just on pouches. The 90s part 4, pouches.
You know, but it does bring up though that this type of thing, these pinup books of women became very popular. And we're talking about the 90s. We cannot ignore the fad or craze of the bad girl era. She, Vampirella, Lady Deathstrike, and the popularity Lady Deathstrike, isn't that an X-Men thing?
Yeah.
Yeah. Lady Death. The popularity of these books, generally awful books with ridiculously drawn, voluptuous women that became extremely popular and sold extremely well. Anybody have any thoughts on the bad girl craze? Who's going to raise their hand and jump in? Brett, go.
Well, they were another crazy cover, because I actually do remember, like, the whole Chaos Comics, the Evil Ernie, Lady Death. And Lady Death was doing a special foil cover every 2 minutes. Vampirella was doing them a lot, too. But I think the thing is that, like, Lady Death really did have value for a good, solid, you know, year or two. There were actually people who would pay money for those issues. But, yeah, it just seemed like there was a new one coming out every 2 weeks. And it was just like, I remember you and I had the store. And the question was, do we order it? Because we knew that the bubble was going to pop real soon. And we didn't want to be left holding the bag
on. Lady Death became popular because it was this crazy woman as close to being nude and as ridiculously drawn as possible, and had a very small print run. But the art wasn't truly bad. It wasn't bad. So of course it had value. But everybody, I mean, even your bigger publishers, Marvel and stuff like that, started coming out with the bikini books, and there was the bad girl craze influenced other publishers as well. And like you say, most of them just sucked. I mean, she at least had a very high quality art, and he was trying to do some good writing. But you look at Razor. I mean, was there a worse book to ever hit the stands than Razor? A lot of this stuff was just beyond crap. Keith, go ahead.
Yeah, and it was odd, just the effect that the Marvel swimsuit issues that were magazine size, which were, you know, kind of half Sports Illustrated swimsuit and half these TNA books that were being published. I remember, like, working at the comic store, and it was a comic store / bookstore / music store, and people were desperate for these Lady Death and I can't remember when Cry for Dawn came in, which was was higher quality, but still kind of on the edge of that genre. And I'm like, I'm looking at this book that the guys are desperate to buy. Let's be honest, the guys were ready to buy. And I'm like, but we actually have a room where you can just go buy pornography. If that's really what you want, I'm not sure why you want to give me $30 for this. I'll take it. But, okay, I mean, if you insist, but
there's... Yeah, you can get more bang for your buck in that room.
Oh, but you're... I was in that room more than a few times, and your tapes are usually 10 to 15 years old. You know, Chris, what to do? What do you have to say to that girl?
I've worn out several copies of Warrior Nun.
Oh, we're gonna get a little blue here, are we?
No,
I actually had the CD that came with one of them.
I did too, and it's Rock Shotgun Mary.
Yeah, that's right. Done by the Something Monkeys or something like that. I wanna say I don't remember specifically, but yeah, nice.
Yeah, no. There was a lot of good bad girl books. Unfortunately, they were not in the majority.
We still see a few of these. I mean, we just had what was it, Victoria Steampunk or something like that? Just came out not long ago. Like this, these things are still around. They're not much, but you know, the odd pinup book still comes out.
And Michael Turner, that's where he got his start. Fathom was just signed for extension on his movie contract.
Okay, so let's move on here. We're talking about some crap. Let's talk about something that was good. We haven't really hit yet the Age of Apocalypse and kind of how the genesis of that, and what a surprise and perhaps brave move by Marvel this was. Who wants to jump in and give their thoughts on that part of the topic? Keith, you're the man. Go ahead.
Still one of my favorite events. It was, I was reading X-Men. I was full into X-Men at that point, every book. And this was such a unique idea at the time. That you would actually shut down the four titles and for 4 months, or the eight titles it was, for 4 months and create this entire new world that existed. It was funny. I was just talking to someone on Twitter today and they said something about, well, Marvel's going to do in AVX some kind of version of Flashpoint. It'll be Marvel's Flashpoint. I'm like, but Flashpoint was just DC's Age of Apocalypse. It just, what goes around comes around. But, yeah, this idea of shutting, they shut everything down. I mean, Flashpoint didn't do that, but, it was so unique and so self-contained and, you know, riffs on characters, new characters, characters that have been dead for years in the X-Men continuity, characters that were big in the X-Men continuity that were dead in this other world. And it was huge, and people were so excited for this. It was the top books every month. Magneto as a hero, no Professor X.
Yeah. And I think it was a very brave move and a very, you know, like I say, very brave and very surprising move as well. Brett, and your thoughts on that?
Well, I love the Age of Apocalypse. Like, I think it's just one of those high watermarks for the X-Men. And I'm not really sure that I wanted to read any X-Men after that because it was just such a good story that it's kind of like, yeah, that's great. Let's leave it there. Because I know that the one thing about it is that they're constantly trying to go back to it. Like, they introduced characters from the Age of Apocalypse into the regular timelines. They're always trying to go back to it because they recognize that it's a high watermark. And so I think that maybe is one of my problems is that, you know, you can't go back again in this case.
So, Chris, what do you think is kind of the legacy of Age of Apocalypse?
Well, actually, I'll tell you this about Age of Apocalypse. I personally feel it is the most overrated of the events. I know everybody, including all three of you, love Age of Apocalypse. But as a non-X-Men reader, I assumed you had, actually. I went back and read.
That was a Zero issue. There's our Zero episode. I never read it.
Oh, okay. Well, you admitted a lot during that one, so.
Chris doesn't listen to our show.
Yeah.
He's behind.
I went back and read the trades, and I found heavy continuity problems, too many characters that I did not know the complete history of, and the characters they brought back, such as Polaris, that had a lot to do with it, I was uninterested in. I do think it was a brave thing to do, and I like similar things being done today, but I really didn't appreciate the series at the time or now. It's a big nothing for me. I think maybe if I went back and actually read the entire run of the Chris Claremont stuff on X-Men, all the way through, it would make more sense. But I'm not convinced they were good, great comic books. I think they were just competent comic books with a novel twist.
I have to imagine either Keith or Brett, one of you has a response to that.
I absolutely have a response for that. Chris, can I trade you something for your trades if you still have them? I'm happy to take them off your hands. Yeah. Well, I'm sure I've got something that I could swap you for.
Okay.
I've been looking
for Warriors of Plasma Zero, perhaps?
I'll turn up something. I can trade you something.
Anybody have anything else to respond to on Chris there?
No, really? I don't want Chris to think twice about reading this book again. I want those trades. Chris, you're right, they're terrible. I'll help you get rid of them.
My thought is that it really could have been worse. It could have been Heroes Reborn.
Well, we'll get to that in a second here, Brett. I want to just go to something a little more chronologically. Something that I did read, and I did also besides Heroes Unborn, which Reborn, which of course I read as well. Acclaim.
That's good.
Valiant Comics had fallen on hard times, especially after the Deathmate crossover. They really fell on hard times. and the property and the publishing became available and was purchased by Acclaim. And Acclaim at the time was one of the biggest video game publishers and companies in the world. And it gave a huge injection of cash into Valiant. And I was excited because they were bringing on good creators, and they put all this money into it. And I thought they were going to be able to market it and really make something with these characters. Truthfully, it seemed like all they wanted was Turok so they could make the video games from him, and highly successful. But it failed on a monumental level as a comic book publishing house. It was great for me because I got Quantum and Woody, and I also love Shaman's Tears, but I know it pisses Chris off. What do you think of Valiant's purchase or Acclaim's purchase of Valiant, Chris?
Yeah, well, I mean, Acclaim paid. They bought Valiant for tons of cash. But really, they were only interested in developing the character video games. They made a Shadow Man video game that was terrible. And I'm unsure, but I thought Shaman's Tears was actually Image.
Windjammer, which was an Acclaim imprint.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I published Shaman's Tears, the incomplete Maggie the Cat, and the director's cut of Star Slayer.
I collected all those.
I
just
that was pretty much it. Like, and they actually
it is out. Possible it started at Image and finished at Valiant. I mean, it's Grell. Anything could happen. at the time, I remember Wizard going crazy. This was going to be a huge, huge deal for the industry and real positive. Didn't turn out to be that. Anybody else have anything to say on that one?
No, I just would like to add, I don't blame Acclaim for the demise of Valiant. I think without Jim Shooter, without a strong head of the company with a clear vision for the comic end.
Wasn't Fabian Nicenza editor-in-chief for them?
Nicenza,
or however you say it, Brett?
Nicenza?
I believe he was in charge of production completely for Acclaim when they took over.
So I feel like you might be right in that case, but
yeah, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, I am unsure of that.
It's not like they didn't get a veteran creative presence. He was a veteran presence, both as a writer and an editor already by that point. So,
oh yes,
Keith,
but,
go ahead.
Sorry, our researchers have just handed me a note that Shaman's Tears was published by Image, the Star Slayer, and Bar Sinister, which was the spinoff from Shaman's Tears, were published by Windjammer.
Bar Sinister. I think that's the one I'm thinking of. You're right. You're right. Yeah. Yeah. I'm just going to say, Acclaim, I thought Acclaim started losing so much money on the video game side that all of a sudden they didn't have the resources to do what they intended to do with the comic book size. And so it was more, I think it was less how they ran the comic books, but there was obviously a disappointment that they didn't get the sales they expected. But I think a lot of it also was just
around like a dead fish.
Yeah, I mean they started losing so much money producing video games that they themselves had a lot of difficulty in that range. So now let's get into something. Speaking of a lot of difficulty, Brett, Heroes Reborn was a huge deal on many levels, and in many people's eyes, a huge fail on many levels. You can go into as much or as little detail on the genesis and publication of this event as you wish. You the man, go Brett.
Well, there's just so much to it. Like, there's just so much there. Like, the Onslaught story...
This may get a show all by itself someday.
It could. The Onslaught story by itself was pretty good, I thought. And I loved the concept, but the thing is that they were so focused on all the Image creators that had made such a big name for themselves, and bringing them back into the fold, you know, just to create these books. And I think that the biggest problem is that they had this grand vision for how long the books were supposed to last, but then the books themselves didn't actually sell very well because I don't think they were very good. And so I think that then it really forced their hands, and it kind of forced them to pull back and come back into the regular universe faster than they really wanted. I mean, obviously Rob Liefeld managed to get to do Captain America again, even after kind of thing, but it was kind of a, nasty little batch of comics there for a while that everybody thought would be very good.
Yeah. And how long did he last on it? I don't think he went all the way through, but
no, he never
did. I think they were on 6 month options.
Let's give a little more background. Keith, why don't you give a little more background into Heroes, why it was such a big deal? What was the event and why it failed?
The general concept.
It was the return of Image, of the guys who left to form Image back to Marvel.
It was massive. It was Rob Liefeld. It was Mark Silvestri. It was Jim Lee. They were doing, and the concept was is that the Avengers characters and Fantastic Four would be killed off in the main universe, and they would be put into this new universe called the Heroes Reborn universe, and they would only connect with each other, and it would be an alternate world that had no mutants. Just as Age of Apocalypse was a world that had very few of the regular powered superheroes, Heroes Reborn would be a world without mutants. And you had four titles: Iron Man, Captain America, Avengers, and Fantastic Four. Now, there was some really, really beautiful artwork in some of these books. Silvestri's Iron Man was amazing. Jim Lee's Fantastic Four, terrific work. But it all felt so temporary. It all felt like something that couldn't last and wouldn't last. And 13 issues later, everyone was right. All the number 6s crossover and all the number 13s crossover, they are available as complete trades. If you can get a deal on them, I suggest picking them up. Picking up Iron Man and Fantastic Four, I'd say, are worth picking up.
Well, at the time that this occurred, there was people who thought this event was permanent and people who thought this event would last a limited amount of time. I kept on hearing going into it, everyone was worried this was permanent. But I believe that, I kept on hearing it was planned to last a year. That was the idea. But, again, the story's bookended by Onslaught. Onslaught's awful. Who is Onslaught? Who wants to jump in and say how much they screwed this up? Keith, you got this one.
I had been buying every X-Men title, as I mentioned, with Age of Apocalypse, and Onslaught shook that. And Zero Tolerance that came up less than a year later was it for me. They were changing a lot of creators out, and Zero Tolerance was where it ended. And I think when I did quit, I probably dumped all my books back to Onslaught. Onslaught was almost a perfect idea. If they had actually had the cojones to finish the story the way it started, it would have been fantastic and still would be shaking the Marvel Universe. But they, of course, wimped out. Basically, there was this incredibly scary character that got introduced in an X-Men comic at the very end of an issue by Juggernaut smashing into the ground at the X-Mansion, completely beat to hell, and he says, Onslaught is coming. And that's the teaser of this big bad that's on his way. And the way it actually pays off is that it's spoiler alert for a 20-year-old comic, that it's Professor X. That it's Professor X and, like, the extension of him into of his bad side into a larger form, mixed with all of the evil things that he sucked out of Magneto's brain when he lobotomized Magneto a couple of years previously. But they wimped out that Onslaught was just a portion of his brain, and Professor X really wasn't that bad after all.
Where were they going to go with it?
I think everything in the story seemed to indicate that they were going to stick with that Professor X was going to stay the big bad. And as usual, the movie was coming up. I can't remember if the cartoon was still on, but all that stuff gets reset to business as usual when you've got a film coming up. Professor X is back running the mansion, sitting in a wheelchair. Onslaught was just a bad dream.
One of the things I think that's interesting about Heroes Reborn is that Captain America had been languishing at near the bottom of the sales for many, many years. Then Mark Waid and Ron Garney took over, and they were about a year into a run and right into the middle of an awesome, awesome storyline. that got interrupted to do Heroes Reborn, and after the character was finally near the top of the sales charts. And even after, though Wade and Garney came back afterwards, they never regained the momentum, and the series never became, wasn't as popular or as good after that. So it really cut off Captain America. On the other hand, the Heroes Reborn version of Iron Man, Will Spartaceo drew some of that in the early issues, and you know, he draws awesome technology, and Iron Man, Tony Stark, was a prick beyond belief. It was a great take on him. I really enjoyed that. What do you think of Heroes Reborn there, Chris?
Actually, what I remember is what you just mentioned, the Wade Garney run on Captain America, which was selling well by the time they had done this, but they had already committed to relaunching all these books because the Avengers stuff just was not selling.
Liefeld wanted X-Men. Captain America.
Yeah.
That's part of the deal. Liefeld wanted to do Captain America, even if it was going to screw everything else up.
Oh, yeah. Even if Marvel isn't going to let him. I mean, he did the fight in American after this with Loeb, same team. Just Marvel canceled Captain America. He went over to a different company and bought the Fighting American, exactly the same comic book. I believe they probably were using the same scripts. Yeah, no, terrible comic books. I didn't like a one of them.
So Heroes Reborn, of course, a complete mess. But what about the Captain America, Chris? The visuals that Liefeld put in there are awful, don't you think?
Completely. I mean, he redesigned Captain America's costume, gave him a little eagle on his forehead instead of the iconic A. And his art, quite frankly, is embarrassing. He really Rob Liefeld it up. I don't personally hate, Rob Liefeld art at Image, but his own personal affectations had hit their height, by this point, and there's some really ugly art. Not Rob Liefeld ugly art as in today where he's just lazy. But he was trying to stylize Captain America and the Avengers. And it really came off badly.
Well, let me put it this way about Rob Liefeld. I just went to type into Google Rob Liefeld Captain America. So I got Rob Liefeld and I started the CA for Captain America. And the Google search finishing thing that it does, the most common phrase, was Rob Liefeld can't draw. And Captain America was number two. So that's what I'm not the only one who thinks this about Rob Liefeld. Rob Liefeld can't draw, apparently a very commonly searched phrase. Captain America. There was one image in particular, Keith, that's famous.
It is. It's a side view of Captain America with a shield by his side. That is considered by some one of the worst pieces of comic art ever created. It was some kind of promotional picture, but it shows up on a ton of bad anatomy sites and bad comic art sites. I think when I did a Google search, it came up under something called awfulart.com, something like that. I actually had been a fan of Rob Liefeld pretty much like until around this time. When he was on New Mutants, I was a big fan of his work. Maybe it was the anchor at the time. Maybe it was that it was just so different. But I loved his New Mutants and his X-Force stuff. And around the time and even the first Youngblood stuff. But yeah, it's right around this time that it just stopped working for me. And it never gotten back, that's for sure.
No, you valued your eyesight.
I would love to know who owns the original penciled art for that page. Like, if somebody
I'll give them 35 cents for it. I'll give them 35 cents so I can burn it. Do us all a favor. It's not worth 35 cents, but I would do it anyways.
To me, like, that would actually, it would almost be worth it just for the sheer, like, disaster that it actually is.
Okay, so anyways, moving on to the kind of the late 90s, I want to get to a couple things here. Image, one of the things that they did to as the comic book market crashed was they hired Larry Marder. They actually hired him in 1993, but you kind of as time moved on as the executive director of Image Comics, you saw them become kind of more what you think of now, more of that small press, independent comic publisher, less about the six that left from Marvel. I believe it was six, wasn't it? But however many it was that left, less about those guys and more about picking up things like Gru and Bone and publishing these things and finding small press guys and kind of that shift in focus from Image. Anybody have thoughts on, I think that's Larry Marder's kind of Bean World. Of course, he was famous for. I think that's part of his legacy there. Keith, you have some thoughts?
Well, I think it was two things happening here. Three things. You had Liefeld that was going off to do Extreme Studios. You had Jim Lee, who essentially created a Marvel DC-esque mini company within Image. I mean, the concept was supposed to be creator-owned, but you have Jim Lee taking all the characters he created and making his own Wildstorm imprint that was really starting to stand on its own. And then Image was trying to find its space in a comic industry that was collapsing so fast. You know, a couple episodes back, the chat we had about Malibu, this is the timing of all of that happening and the industry just imploding over those couple of years. And, you know, Image trying to, by grabbing things like Gru, things that, you know, going into direct competition with Dark Horse on things that Dark Horse had been doing for a long time. And it helped them get through this period. But Top Cow was an imprint at that time, doing the same kind of thing of creating its own little sub-universe.
Now, Brett, one of the things that came out of Image was Homage. Your thoughts on that?
Well, there was a lot of books in that I actually really enjoyed. I loved Leave It to Chance. I thought that was a really, really good book, another James Robinson book. And then, you know, that was the one that also gave us Strangers in Paradise for the little bit of time that he spent over at Image. So, I mean, it was an interesting try. I actually think one of the interesting things about Image near the end of the decade was the fact that for all of their creator-owned, you know, bluster, they came to realize that as a creator, you can't necessarily continue working on the same book forever. And so eventually...
Dave Sim.
Eric Larson being the exception to that rule.
Yeah, that's true. But really, I mean, all of them let other people do the books at a certain point. Like, and it just became like any other Marvel or DC thing where it's, sure, it's owned by a creator. So what? You know, I mean, they're barely working on the book. So I just found it really interesting that Image at the end really just wound up becoming what they didn't want or what they hadn't intended to become.
Yeah, it's work for hire for Wildstorm different than work for hire for DC.
No.
Yeah, and then Wildstorm became DC, so bam!
We'll get there. Chris, Homage, though, had a different feel as an imprint within Image, didn't you think?
Well, definitely, but I think it's worth noting what was happening in the industry right at that time. Marvel had announced that they were going to their own distributor. Diamond was pressuring smaller independent, smaller books to sign exclusively with them. It was a scary time to be a small publisher. And Image just offered an umbrella with Homage to these smaller publishers saying, you know what, we will take over the publishing duties. You just worry about the creative thing. And I think for a group of artists, it was the proper thing to do. And I think it's still why Image exists today. If Image hadn't sought these out, I don't think they exist. You look at their lineup today and, you know, aside from the odd Savage Dragon, it's a lot of creator-owned books. They really developed a template for them to continue it with this way. And we forget that Bone went over to Image for an issue or two, I believe, during this era.
Well, so many people went over to Image because I think they expected it to be better than it was. But then the market did clear up a little bit, and allowed them to go back to, you know, cartoon books and also abstract. You know, in the case of Strangers in Paradise, they were able to go back. It just, in this case, the grass wasn't greener on the other side.
Okay, so let's move on here to another publisher that opened up kind of around this mid-90s era, and that's Oni Press. Keith, early memories of Oni?
I think the Clerks things would have been the first things I saw from Oni. Kevin Smith doing new chapters in the lives of Jay and Silent Bob. This was a time when I thought, when I liked Jay and Silent Bob, I cannot stand those films anymore. I should say I can't stand the subsequent films. I still love the first films, but not the later ones. But they did the Clerks, The Lost Scene. There was a Clerks Christmas story. There was the lost chapter between Mallrats and Chasing Amy of what Jay and Silent Bob were up to and why they were where they were in Dogma, etc. It's some interesting stuff there. That's kind of all I remember of Oni at that point, though.
Anybody else have early memories of Oni?
I remember Whiteout.
Yeah.
That was a good series.
I've still never read the second volume of it.
It's also really, really good. It's really, really good. Another one that opened up, another publisher that opened up and was kind of trying to do a more of a superhero flair certainly was CrossGen. And it unfortunately, I mean, they actually lasted for quite a few years. But, you know, Mark Waid and Barbara Kiestel and Ron Mars had a lot to do with CrossGen. I know it was one I was really excited for. I got every issue, and I couldn't believe when I was done, the first wave, Seagull, I don't know how you pronounce that, Mystic, Meridian, Scion. How do you say that? Anybody?
Scion.
Yeah. Scion. There you go. I remember just reading these books and putting them down and going, there wasn't a single one I want to come back to. And that was really disappointing for me because I looked at the creators, and I looked at these books, and I was really hoping for them to be very strong. Another publisher we're going to talk about here, IDW, kind of first popped up in 1999, I believe, really, really late. Does anybody else have any memories of seeing IDW or the first book they might have collected from that?
I remember I got really excited because they picked up the old first comic series, both Grimjack and once again Grell. They picked up his John Sable Freelance and started doing reprints.
Those are gorgeous books. I'm collecting those right now.
They're beautiful. I hope you're getting the omnibuses.
I'm getting the reprint trades like I did. I'm getting the trades, but I'm getting a deal on them. I'm looking around for the deals.
Okay, because they're huge. Books. I mean, they're expensive.
You know, one of the things that we see from DC kind of in the last half of the 90s was they were desperate. I think you saw a lot of desperation from them. You saw, you know, and they said that they had planned this for a long time, but you saw Clark Kent finally marry Lois Lane. You saw Superman become Electric Superman. You had a lot of events like the continuing the yearly crossover, not really seeing me have a game plan for them, but things like the 1 million, Final Night was actually a good miniseries, but that was rare. But in that, you know, Hal Jordan became good again. It's kind of like, okay, we pissed everybody off, so let's make him good again. Then let's make him the Spectre and make him a hero again and bring him back. And we have to appease everybody we pissed off and we're desperate. And that kind of seemed to be the strategy for me, and it continued to fail for a long time over at the core DC universe. Brett, what do you think?
Well, you know, I went back and read through the Superman, the Electric Superman, and honestly, any interest that I had in actually kind of restarting DC from that certain point just died right there. Like, like you mentioned all this stuff, and I'm pretty much like, nope, I haven't read it. I haven't read it at all.
Death of Clark Kent was another one, I think. Just desperation. Just flying out of them.
Yeah.
A cataclysm for The Underworld miniseries killing off a bunch of characters, Cataclysm for Batman. It certainly felt like they were a company trying to create events still, and just okay. desperate.
Okay, let's talk about something quickly. How could anyone not look at a one sheet for Red versus Blue Superman and think, this is a bad idea?
Yeah,
I think they all had bad creators.
I think they all sat around, they looked at that and went, gold.
I think they all sat around and went, we're desperate, we gotta do something, we've already killed them. And I think that was DC's strategy largely. Meanwhile though, I think by 1995 and going on, Vertigo though had really established itself as being the one place that every book left was really quality. And Vertigo, I think, had a really strong run in the late 90s personally. Keith, what do you think?
Absolutely. I mean, by about the mid-90s, I was collecting anything that had Vertigo's name on it. I mean, this is a period where you have Transmetropolitan, you have Preacher, you know, two of the best books I've ever read. You have Garth Ennis and Warren Ellis was working there, and amazing stuff month after month. Every mini that came out was terrific, and they just had a run. You know, as Sandman was getting to its end, unbelievable work. And work that was, I mean, as trade paperbacks had then, by then caught on. And the secondary market, the bookstore market, and, you know, and comic stores having these bookshelves of trades became a thing all of a sudden. I mean, this was a new stream of money for comic stores that were really struggling, that you could keep stock that was valuable couple of months down the road, as opposed to needing to cycle through your monthlies. The stock you could replace as it was sold.
Anybody have some remaining memories of mid to late 90s Vertigo?
Sandman Mystery Theater.
Good one.
There you go. There was another event that was very, very important that occurred, and that was in 1994. When an artist who everybody recognized as being a very, very talented artist, but still just an artist and not a huge name, had a little buzz, worked over and worked in, you know, for DC, did the Ray miniseries, that type of thing, decided to start his own company. And that was Event Comics and Joe Quesada. And ended up publishing Painkiller Jane. And there was a book from George Perez, but he was doing that for many, many years. And he was Ash was his own book, and he wrote that himself until very late when Larry Robinson came on. But he wrote that himself along with Jimmy Palmiotti. And this is, if he doesn't open Event Comics, he's probably not editor in chief of Marvel right now, I think. Anybody agree with that?
Definitely.
I don't think he is editor in chief of Marvel right now, but that's that's not really.
Perhaps he isn't. Well, Publisher, I'm still in the 70s, so I think I did pretty good knowing that.
Yeah.
Joe Quesada was editor-in-chief, and now he's what, chief creative officer or something like that? I'm not sure what really the difference is between that and editor-in-chief, but I guess he's just working more on the – but he was editor-in-chief for a while. But, you know, it was a big deal. He went over to this led to him going over and doing the Marvel Knights imprint for Marvel and having a lot of creative control in the company. Taking over from, I think it was Bob Harris who was president before him after DeFalco, is that correct?
Yeah, I believe Bob Harris was the EIC. Yeah.
And under Quesada, and Quesada's made his friends and his enemies, but they really have, they really found a resurgence, and he had a lot of interesting ideas. So he showed up in 1998, but unfortunately for me, he was part of a Daredevil storyline that I absolutely hated. Chris, what did you think of Quesada and Palmiotti and their kind of running over to Marvel and the first runs of what they did?
Oh, you're referring to the Kevin Smith Daredevil, aren't you?
It was a big deal for him to bring Kevin Smith over with him to write that book at the time. Brought a lot of interest.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I know you hate Guardian Devil. I don't particularly love it either. He brought in a whole bunch of talent and created a whole bunch of interesting Marvel Knights books. the failure of that one storyline, I think, is the exception to the rule. I really think Quesada's role as editor-in-chief was to go, what shouldn't we do? And then he did it well. Thus is the story of Wolverine Origins. I don't particularly like that storyline either, but I'm in the minority on that one.
Another big event that had kind of happened then in the late 90s was America's Best Comics, ABC, and Wildstorm, and kind of their storyline. Brett, why don't you give a little bit of history on that?
Well, Alan Moore had wanted to write some more comic books, which is absolutely fine. That was really where League of Extraordinary Gentlemen and then all of his Tom Strong, Prometheus, all that stuff came through. But he started it with Wildstorm. But again, Alan Moore, being the mercurial self that he is, got really pissed off when he found out that DC was in talks to purchase Wildstorm and then did so, because Alan Moore had vowed never to work for DC again. So really, America's Best Comics really had like a good solid run of a couple of years before Alan Moore just kind of said, you know, screw this, I can't work with DC, and I don't even want to be involved really anymore with the company. So I think they still sporadically release some books, but yeah, he wanted to be as far away from DC as possible there.
I remember I kept on reading these books from ABC, thinking they got to be good, they're Alan Moore, and yet never really enjoying any of them. Did you read these books, Chris?
I read a couple of them. I really like League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. The Tom Strong, I get where he was going. I put it in the same category as Alan Moore's image book, 1963. It's his throwback to a previous time book. Really, I think Alan Moore at this time was just trying to undo everything he did with comic books with The Watchmen.
These really were not grim and gritty books by any means.
No. They're all right reads. I don't hate them. I'll read them when I can pick them up cheap. But they're not a must-own.
Well, League of Extraordinary Gentlemen is actually quite pretty dark at points. There's some really crazy stuff that goes on in that book.
It's the exception to the rule, though.
Yeah, there's no question. The other stuff is just, again, Alan Moore deconstructing comic books for the 900th time. Yes.
It's a middling success in this one. So, Brett, we've gone through the entire 90s. What are your final thoughts on the 90s?
Well, I think that there is probably a lot more to the 90s that I remember that now that we're bringing up. So much happened, and I think it's shocking to realize that. I mean, from the fact that you and I had our store and then closed our store within that point, that there was companies that started up, there was companies that closed, there was, you know, like, I mean, Image had its boom. I mean, there was just so much that happened, and it shocks me that you know, we are still feeling the effects from it. But, you know, there's a lot of good stuff from the 90s. And I won't miss a lot of the extra covers. And I certainly won't miss Warriors of Plasm Zero.
Chris, your final thoughts on the 90s?
Just that it was we really talked about a lot of the negatives of the 90s. But there were some phenomenal books published at all times during this era. It's just the sheer volume of comics being published at that point. There was a lot of embarrassment. I was going to say embarrassment of riches, but there was a lot of crap. I love the night they published some of my favorite books. They published some of my favorite books, but I also don't think we'll ever see a point in comic books that books of such low quality will ever be published on a regular basis.
That's what Digital Force is for.
You know what? We're going to go out final thoughts on the 90s from the person with the voice of reason. So I guess I'll go next and let Keith finish. But comic books never saw a rise, a boom, an interest ever like they did in the 90s. And they never saw it go as small and nearly collapse and almost shut down to some degrees if you listen to some people talk about it. You know, I mean, Marvel going through bankruptcy and that type of thing. And all just within a few years. I think it's the most interesting decade. I don't think you ever sat in a decade with as many different fads like that. The crossovers, the covers. And by the way, I wouldn't mind if some covers came back. Some of them were cool.
More bullet holes.
The gimmick covers, the crossovers, the bad girls, the whatever. It really was. You have an image forming, despite their best intentions, by the time we're talking about Image ending in the late 90s, it is in no way, I don't think, the image of what those creators originally had. But on the other hand, it's evolved into something probably better than they could have imagined by the year 2012.
It's the new Vertigo.
It's the new Vertigo. But one of the things that was interesting was in the 90s, I felt like a lot of power was with the artists. And people were chasing the artists. Who's the next hot artist? That's the book we're going to buy. And by the late 90s, the writers had the power. I think now it's more like a good balance. But by the late 90s, people were following the writers. And it was your Ennis and your Ellis and your even a guy like Mark Waid and these guys. That was, you know, Kurt Busiek. That was who people were following, and that was who had the power, and that was why we started to see some quality when the writers started to get a little bit of power too, and pull that back. But maybe it went too far the other way, and that's kind of my final thoughts on the end of the 90s and the beginning of the 90s. And it, Keith, what did you think?
Well, as I look back over all this, you know, having worked at the store in the early 90s, my highest point of the time I was buying the most comics, you know, the time where it was comics before groceries, was in the early 90s. And then as we got into this
later, was it ever comics before toilet paper? Because that was number one. I went food.
I had roommates.
I went toilet paper. I went toilet paper, food, rent, comic books. But hey.
I had roommates and we could have a staring match. There were always Warriors of Plasma issues around if I got desperate. So,
I was waiting for a Liefeld reference, but hey, you respect your ass too much to wipe it with a Liefeld book.
Well, that's what I'm retiring on. The low point for me though, as we looked at these times, you know, as you get into the later companies and such, I had essentially quit comics around 1998 and was away from them for a few years where I only got maybe two or three books a month. And usually I just trade weighted on whatever Warren Ellis and Garth Ennis were doing. And that was about it. That was kind of it for me for several years. And, it wasn't until Garth Ennis's Punisher that I really started getting back into comics around 2002. When I came across Welcome Back, Frank, that was when I started really getting back in. So it's highs and lows. DC was my favorite company at the start of the 90s, and by the end of the 90s was almost unreadable. X-Men was one of my favorites in the early 90s, and again, I hadn't touched one from about 97 on. So such a mixed bag. It was a long decade, and a lot of stuff happened. I do want to end with one thing that I just came across, because I was looking at... As I was preparing, I looked over just what was the top book of each month of each year over the late 90s, trying to get a bit of a sense of flow. Certainly X-Men, Spawn, all those. But there was a month where Darkness, number 11, was the number one book. As I looked over the top books of the year, Darkness number 10 was nowhere near that. Darkness number 9 was nowhere near that. And I couldn't figure out why. And before we started recording tonight, I asked the guys, they couldn't remember anything about it. It was 97 or whatever. And then I clicked on the book and saw the Darkness number 11 had top names doing each of the 15 covers of that book. And that's why it was the number one book of the month. And that, to me, is so the 90s.
That's the 90s in a nutshell.
Exactly. Just Darkness number 11, why was it big? Well, take a look at who was doing the covers. Everything you need to know about the 90s is in that month.
All right, that's the 90s, everybody. Thank you very much for staying with us on that. We hope you had fun. We did. We're going to move on to our little bit here. Keith, what are we going to do? Some reviews?
Here I come to save the day.
We're saving you from bad comics.
All right, Brett, open up your first review.
I'll start off with Valiant's second offering, Harbinger number 1. This one reminded me a lot of Exo Manowar in that it took an awful long time to kind of get going. At least something happened at the end a little bit. I didn't love the art very much. I would have preferred Kerry Nord be on this book as well. And the writing is fine. But, you know, based on all the tweets that I read and stuff like that, I guess I expected more out of it. I really wanted it to be some sort of big, like, this is the Summer of Valiant. I wanted it to be the Summer of Valiant. And so far, I'm just not that excited about it. I mean, they tweet out a lot of stuff, but yeah, I'm not really into it right now. So maybe the second issue will be better, but it just didn't really work for me.
Chris, it's your turn.
Alrighty. Harbinger. I hated this book. I originally loved it. It was probably the one I thought I would love the most. I love the 90s Valiant version of Harbinger. But they've made the main characters oxycodone-fueled rapists. I don't know quite get what I'm supposed to like about these guys. Instead of teens running from an evil corporation, I mean, I want these guys put away. They're a danger. I don't get what I'm supposed to like about these guys. Hated the book.
Rapists, what do they think this is? The Ultraverse or the Ultimate Marvel Universe's version of Hank Pym? Anyways, Keith, your thoughts on Harbinger?
You know, up till 30 seconds ago, I liked this book. But I think Chris has actually, in very few seconds, convinced me that it was a huge steaming pile. I thought I liked it. And then as he encapsulated it like that, I went, wait, that is what happens in the book. Oh my God. that is really what I read.
That is very true.
Yeah. I great review, Chris. You have actually changed my mind about something that I read myself and didn't, and thought I liked, but. As you encapsulated it, and I thought back, no, that is the plot. That's what he's describing is an accurate description of what happens in the book. Oh my God.
Well, Keith, why don't you go and do your next review then?
Well, let's talk about, creator-owned heroes. You can read my full review on Comicosity, but we'll talk about the two stories because there's some extra content of interviews and such. We've got a Steve Niles, Kevin Mellon story called American Muscle. And we've got a Palmiotti Gray with art by Phil Noto called Trigger Girl 6. The Niles story is a post-apocalyptic, looking like it's going to be a horror. Not totally sold on the art. There is a tremendous two-page spread. I read it in PDF. I'm assuming it's a two-page spread. That I really dug. I'd like to have that as a poster, actually. An interesting book. It is very set up. It is a very serialized chapter one of whatever. So not a self-contained story. Interested to see where he goes. So far, so good. If it was on its own, I doubt actually I would continue. However, it's not on its own. It is in the book with Trigger Girl 6, one of the best debuts I've read in a long time. I loved Trigger Girl 6. It is a self-contained story that sets up for more chapters. It's fun. The art is really cool. There's a great costuming up sequence that's wordless that is really cool. And I just had fun with the book. Trigger Girl 6 is just plain fun. And thanks to our pal Chris at Alpha Comics, who shoved this to the top of my list, told me that this was the one to look at, and he said that he's already sold out of his first issue. He had reordered before he even hit the shelves, because he just knew that this was the one.
Thoughts, Chris?
Yeah, I'm a huge fan of the anthology book. I don't know after the initial storylines are done whether they plan to continue with this format of just introducing new stuff here and there. But I liked both the stories. I'm not as big on Trigger Girl as Keith, but good reads, both books. Definitely buying the issue number two.
And your thoughts, Brett?
Well, it's interesting that we're seeing a lot of this magazine-style format for the anthologies as well that feature more than just comic book content, you know, a lot of the interviews and stuff like that. I totally respect what they're doing with this. I like the idea that they're kind of trying to bring more creator-owned stuff out, and I know Palmiotti and Gray are really into that. The American Muscle story reminded me a lot of a movie that I watched that was lit on the worst movies of all time list. So I assume that it will go away from that, but it's kind of weird because and I don't think that Steve Niles has seen it at all, but it just has the same tone to it. So I'm not sure about that. And Trigger Girl 6, I thought was stupid. I thought it was just dumb, and the main part about it that I liked was the fact that there was so little script that I could read it faster and get through it faster. The art was about the only positive that I have to it. And Keith, I don't know why you're up Jimmy Palmiotti's ass so much, but I just don't get it. He's not that good. So Trigger Girl 6, I would not be back for that.
Keith, you got to give a rebuttal.
I thought it was really, really fun. I quite enjoyed it. I've been enjoying Palmiotti and Gray for a while. If you go back and check the tapes on my review of The Ray, I'm not necessarily always a fan.
That's true. That is very true.
That's one of the shittiest rebuttals I've ever heard in my entire life. You're off the debate team.
Great. Now I'll need
Brett.
Now I'll need a new thing to do on my lunch hour.
Brett, you can always join the band club. Brett, why don't you give our next review?
All right. Well, I'll talk about the Dark Avengers Becomes Thunderbolts. I don't actually know. I think it's a Thunderbolts issue. I don't think it's a Dark Avengers. Now, I haven't read Thunderbolts in many, many moons, and I've never read a Dark Avengers comic. So I was really somewhat confused going in on the whole concept of anything. But, you know, at the end of it, I thought that the story was fine and what happened was okay. And I suppose it just reminded me a lot of a superhero comic book. And so it was just like, you know, in a different point in my life, I'll bet you I would have really liked this book. Right now, there's so much else out there that competes for it that I probably wouldn't read it. I liked it just fine, but I probably wouldn't read it. But the number one thing I don't like about it is why do they have to keep doing these things to Luke Cage? I really like Luke Cage, but why the hell do they have to keep throwing him in with the crappy teams? Like, all right, now Luke Cage leads the Dark Avengers as the Thunderbolts. Whoa! Hello! You know, I'm tired of it. I just want Luke Cage back with Iron Fist.
Yeah, that's the team he should be with.
Power Man and Iron Fist, that's it. That's all I want.
That's it. Chris, you know what? When we're talking Thunderbolts, you're the guy we go to. Go.
Yes, yes. I am the only one reading this book on a regular basis. This is Thunderbolts 175, with a bold new direction. They're supposedly changing up the team and making it the Dark Avengers. And I have to say, I am not sure of this direction. I'm not a big fan of, Scar, the son of Hulk. Luke Cage
is not being written as Luke Cage. In previous issues, he has been. In conclusion, Dark Avengers number 1/Thunderbolts 175. It's par for the course. We've had a very good run on Thunderbolts. It seems like they're changing it up. Whether the storyline gets better or not, I think is still to be decided. If you're a Thunderbolts fan, don't let this issue scare you. But as a jump on point, I'd say don't buy it.
Way in there, Keith.
Well, we promised you at the top of the Wii Views we would save you from bad comics. So my review is do not read this comic under no circumstances. If you have to in your pull,
awesome.
Go back to the shelf, hide it behind something. Don't leave the store with this comic in your hand. Give it to someone. Buy a different comic. Say that you will purchase a different comic for the same value if you are not leaving the store with this book.
Let's move on to the next book, the biggest book of the week, that I refuse to read on principle. Minutemen. Keith, what do you think?
Well, it's okay. I know, I kind of feel like I wanted to come in with,
that's like the,
you know,
most muted.
I wanted to come in with, it was the most amazing thing all
my,
ever.
My vitriol and anger doesn't seem worthwhile for a book that's okay.
This is probably the least expected reaction from me is, you know, as far as what I thought I was going to get out of this book, from this one alone, from this one on its own, as the only thing that's out there right now, it all seems like such, like, a big deal over something I barely remember reading. It was fine. It wasn't bad. Nothing wowed me. It's interesting to read a bit more about Silhouette, for example. It's Minutemen, so it's Hollis Mason, who was the original Night Owl, thinking back over the other people that were in the Minutemen with him. So we're, you know, it's kind of like bringing the text pieces from the Watchmen maxi series to life. But the last time I read the Watchmen, which was just last week, I skipped the text pieces this time because I've read them and, you know, it's not the main story. It felt a lot like that. You can read it or not read it. And I it was just fine.
I say you cannot read it because that's what I did. Chris, what do you think?
Actually, I can definitely see what Keith is saying. My main concern was how these new writers would interpret the Watchmen stories rather than how well they really did at it. Because I didn't want anything to interfere. I didn't want a reborn situation. I didn't want these characters reinvented for the modern age. I just wanted more stories. That's what this is. They had me on page 2. Page 1, Darwin Cook seems to be doing his New Frontier thing. And then he flips a switch on us. And it's not his typical style. I really enjoyed issue 1. I can't say anything really happened. But I enjoyed spending time with these characters that I love.
You know who else enjoys spending time with those characters that he loves? Alan Moore. Brett, these guys aren't giving me enough emotion or anger over this. Come on. Come on. Give me some.
This book was like a comfortable pair of slippers. It was nice to go back into.
You son of a bitch.
But there is no vitriol to be had for this book because there's not enough in the story. I like it. I like the characters. You know, maybe there'll be vitriol when we get to Rorschach and the Comedian and stuff like that. But, you know, until that point, you know, it's just like, I like these characters.
Grr. Anyways, Keith, you have something to say there, Keith?
Yeah, sure. I think just subsequent to what Brett said, you know, about once we get into these other characters, it was an interesting spot to start. Yeah, I did wonder why Minutemen was the first one off the block, because it's not the best known. What I'm hearing is the Comedian actually is going to be maybe the number one of the four that are debut this month. And then Rorschach debuts next month. That expected to be the number one next month. But it was a gentle way to get in. It is the characters that we spent the least time with in the original Watchmen. I think that I did have an interesting discussion with someone today of, someone said, jokingly about the controversy about Earth 2, what happens if they introduce a gay character into Before Watchmen? And my reaction was, but there already is, Silhouette is gay in the Watchmen books. And depending on how you read it, there's at least one, maybe two other gay characters. But it made me think, but depends on how you read it. And in a couple of weeks, those books are going to come out, and it may tell you. And I don't know how I feel about that. That, when you read the original Watchmen, there is an uncertainty, and you can read it one way or the other. In a couple of weeks, that's going to become concrete. And someone's going to have made a decision.
Let's move on here, Keith. You kind of brought these books to us, so why don't you give the first review of these independent books that that we had a chance, the pleasure of reading?
Well, we got some books from Kronos Publishing. We got Bloodhound Law and Legacy. Some really interesting art in Bloodhound Law. I think that the positive thing I'd say about it is that it is the inks are very nice. The style is interesting, the way that the pages are laid out. It goes from kind of a layered look to big spreads, big open framings. The negative I'd say is that very clearly characters have been based on actors. And I never kind of get away from that. Specifically the Robert Redford looking guy. I don't quite get past it, and I think some photo reference from someone a little less recognizable than Robert Redford might have been a better decision. It's an interesting story, cowboy kind of thing. I would, not being to be continued might have helped. A little jarring again at the end when we get someone who's very, very clearly based on Lawrence Fishburne. So I'd say take a look at it and judge for yourself.
Well, it's interesting that you mention that about the actors, Keith, because when I looked at the art originally, I thought that it looked really good. But then I actually, as I kind of went through it, I started to realize that the backgrounds are very nice and the inking is very nice, but everybody has kind of a white outline around them as well. And it looks like they're almost added in Photoshop. Like, everybody just has kind of a layered on feel, and I found that really took me out of the book. There's some really nice elements to that art, but it was just a little too weird for me. As far as the story for Bloodhound Law goes, I didn't like any of the characters, and so I found that made it really hard for me to care or be interested. Like, I'm not a huge Western guy to begin with, so maybe I'm not the right guy to be talking about this, but the characters just struck me as really just bad people, and so it didn't really work for me as a whole.
You know what? That's interesting to me, Brett, because I like the characters so much. I found them to be guys I'm like, cool, interesting guys I want to know more about. I don't know if I necessarily want to hang with them, but I want to know more about. Like, I thought they're really, that was my favorite thing in the book. That and this book, both books actually had such an interesting look. I just love the different visuals and the unique styles. I enjoyed this book quite a bit. I enjoyed the other book that we'll get to in more, even more, but I liked Bloodhound Law personally. Chris, what do you think?
Bloodhound Law, I really love the story. The characters have sort of a moral ambiguity about them that makes them compelling. They feel real to me. I will say the photo reference thing does get a little bit grating, specifically because they're spot on. There's no way you can deny that that's Robert Redford and Lawrence Fishburne. But the art is good. It's just a little too photo real. But I agree with Mo. I fell in love with these characters. I have no idea where this is going. And I'm really interested in to see this little morality play out. I don't know where they're going. And that's considering, a Western, a genre, thing. Usually you kind of have some idea where you're going. I don't with this one, and I'm in for long haul on this one.
You know what? And I'm not bothered by the photorealistic, obvious movie actors thing because I've read Brian Hitch. So, you know, after that, really, what can piss you off? Let's move on to the other book here, Keith.
Yes, the other one from Kronos is called Legacy. And similar art style, very different genre. I was hard-pressed to get my head around what was happening in this story, to be honest. We're thrown a lot of information, and it's very urban violence. It's very creepy guys saving people. I kind of couldn't get my head around what I'm supposed to be focused on in the story, you know, which character is supposed to be the lead. You know, if you go by the cover, it's the woman, but inside it's a little less linear than that. So I think this one I don't think I would be back on.
We'll move on to Brett's review then.
All right. Well, for Legacy, you know, I was happier to see it not be a Western in this case, but a lot of the same problems with the art for me. And yeah, like Keith, I found the story to be a little confusing. And again, the characters just didn't offer that much for me. So, unfortunately, neither of the books really, really worked for me. And at the end of the day, I just can't imagine reading them again.
See, and again, here's another one. I mean, I really like this. I read the first two issues of this, fortunately. This is a story I love, again, the unique look of this publisher. So it's different, and I need that every now and then, where in a world where everything's so cookie cutter. And as far as the characters and the story, it doesn't have the most original feel, but I liked the characters. I was intrigued with them. And there was never a single point where I didn't know what was going on, even though there was a lot of stuff that came at me very quickly and changed a lot. I was able to quickly assimilate and felt like I understand the characters, the situations, and their motivations. I always knew, I really, really thought this flowed really perfectly for me. I thought Legacy was tremendous, and I highly recommend it.
All right, Legacy. Unlike Blood and Law, I didn't find myself connecting to any of the characters. I actually blame the art style. I don't think for an action, a heavy action comic book, this art style leads to any degree of realism. I'm not going to read issue two. I only read issue one. Bad comic book. Didn't like it. Keith?
I just want to tag that chronoscomics.com is where you can take a look at these books and order them through that site.
Yeah, and varying opinions. So we should read it yourself and decide. Some final shout-outs. Brett, what do you got?
All right. Well, I want to thank our buddy Chris, Comic Canuck, for coming on quickly to explain himself. And let's see now. Afterwards, Comicosity, of course, a couple of reviews that I put up, one for Prophecy, number one, which I found amusing because I wasn't such a big fan of the art, but the artist still retweeted the review. So, you know, my thanks to him. And Elephant Men, number zero, which I just absolutely loved. Great series. But otherwise, it's more of the same, more Comicosity reviews, perhaps another blog coming up, and keep on checking out Brett_WeTalk at Twitter, and then Brett@WeTalkPodcast.com, and there's going to be some cool stuff coming up on WeTalkPodcasts.com.
Keith.
All right, you can follow me on Twitter. I am CubReporterK on Twitter. And you can email me at keith@wetalkpodcast.com. Now, there were several intentional errors put into tonight's episode. Feel free to find them and tweet us. They were, of course, on purpose.
Yes, it's a game.
I'm sure we will start this keep this game going.
Next episode and every subsequent. Hey, everybody, I'm Mo, the Crown Prince of Charisma. Let's not forget that part. Special shout out to Paul O'Connor. You guys know him as Long Box Graveyard, and he's going to be coming on doing a once a month, podcast for us. He already has his schedule set, so look onto that. We're negotiating for some other people to come on and do some other podcasts and blogs and stuff with us as well. If you're interested in the podcast show, you think it'll fit in, or you want to blog for us or We Talk Wrestling or anything, contact me, mo@wetalkpodcast.com. Or mo_WeTalk on Twitter. You know, we'll see what you got and maybe we have some fun. Also want to mention that, we are joining and we're supporting Comics Tribe. You remember that publisher that we had some, gentlemen on before? They're going to be having their books coming out from Diamond soon. And, they have something called the Street Team. The Comics Tribe Street Team, and you can find on the front page some more information. Click on the banner, and you can go to their website. But essentially, you're going to go out there, and you're going to let the publisher or the retailers know that these guys exist and where to find them. And for that, you'll get some free swag and some previews and everything like that. It's a pretty cool little deal that they're doing, so we recommend that as well. And, of course, something else that's kind of related to that Comics Tribe thing. We're going to be doing our next show will be called Kickstarter My Heart. So I'm sure you guys can figure what that out is, what that's about. We're going to be highlighting the Kickstarter, kind of some comic books that are using Kickstarter to get funding. And we're going to have some short interviews and talk a little bit about that. So that'll be our next episode. And hey, if you're on Kickstarter or you know somebody on Kickstarter, you can certainly contact us for that next episode. Again, we've given our contact information, so feel free to do that. And we think that one's going to be a lot of fun. But also, you definitely want to check out the Comic Podcast Network, of which we're now affiliated as well. So other than that, I am OUT. Chris, you've got the final word this week.
Well, I guess we're finishing off the 90s here. So if you guys need a POG or anything like that, give me a shout-out at Chris_WeTalk on Twitter or Chris@WeTalkPodcast.com. This week, we lost a true literary visionary, Ray Bradbury. And just to end off the podcast, we're going to play a radio show that he wrote the story for. The radio show is X-1, and the story is Zero Hour. No relationship to the 90s crossover.
Countdown for blast off. X-5, 4, 3, 2, X-1, fire. From the far horizons of the unknown come transcribed tales of new dimensions in time and space. These are stories of the future, adventures in which you'll live in a million could-be years on 1,000 maybe worlds. The National Broadcasting Company, in cooperation with Street & Smith, publishers of astounding science fiction, presents
X-1.
Tonight's story, Zero Hour by Ray Bradbury.
It was a perfect summer day in the year 1985. Sunlight illumined the suburbs, and the town drowsed on a tide of warm, sunlit air. On the lawns, the children played. And in the homes, busy mothers prepared for the evening arrival of their husbands.
Excuse me, Mom.
Good heavens, Mink. What's all the excitement?
We're playing a game, Mommy, the most exciting game ever.
What are you doing in that cabinet?
I need some tools from Daddy's kit.
Your father may not
want... I'll take good care of them, Mom, I promise.
Very well, dear. Don't lose anything. Oh, what's the name of the game, Mink?
Invasion.
Oh, invasion. What will they think of next?
This, and this, and this, and this. Put that over there, and bring that over here. No, you ninny. Now, get back while I fix this. They want it this way. See?
Sure. Just let me fix this.
We'd better talk to Drill and get some more instructions, Art.
Where is Drill? Drill? Hey, Drill! Drill!
He's in the rosebush, I think. I'll talk to him myself. And you write it down on the pad.
Okay.
Drill? Drill? Okay. Drill wants you to write down triangle.
What's a triangle?
Never mind. Drill will tell us when he wants us to know. It helps the invasion.
Well, how do you spell it?
Drill, how do you...
Shh! Mink, here's your mother, looking out the window.
Mink, who are you talking to?
The rosebush, Mom. Only it's not really a rosebush. That's Drill. Well,
who's Drill?
He's planning the invasion.
Oh, what an imagination. You'd better come in, dear, and clean up for supper.
In just a second, Mom. Art, did you write down what Drill just said?
Yup. 4, 9, 7, and A, and B, and X, and a fork, and a string, and a hexagony.
Hexagonal, droopy.
Oh.
Come in, Mink. Supper's in 10 minutes.
Okay, Mom. Just a minute. I have to tell Drill. I wish we didn't have to eat, though. It holds up the invasion.
Mink, for heaven's sake, slow down. You'll choke on that soup.
I can't, Mom. It's a matter of life and death.
What's a matter of life and death?
The invasion.
What invasion is that?
Oh, just some silly game the children have been playing.
Well, whatever it is, Mink, it'll wait until you've finished your supper, I'm sure.
But Drill is waiting for me, Daddy.
Oh, who's Drill? New boy in the neighborhood?
He's new, all right. Only you can't see him. Not yet. He hasn't come through yet.
What do you mean you can't see him?
He lives in a rose bush in our backyard.
Oh.
Imagination, Henry.
Mm-hmm. Well, while you're at it, tell me more about this new game.
It's Martians invading Earth, Dad.
What?
Well, not exactly Martians, Dad. They're from... I don't know. From up.
And from the inside of that little head of yours.
You're laughing. Drill said you would. You'll kill Drill and everybody.
Well, I didn't know you could kill a Martian.
Not really a Martian, Mom. Maybe he's from Jupiter. Or Venus, even.
Imagine.
They couldn't figure out a way to attack the Earth. So the kids are helping the Martians.
Oh, pretty slick, those Martians, using the kids for a fifth column, eh, Mary?
Drill says after the invasion, we can stay up as late as we want. No more baths, either.
Oh, is that so?
And we can watch all the grown-up televisor shows.
Well, I don't wonder this invasion has caught on among the kids.
Some of the kids are giving us trouble, like Dale Britz and Petey Jerick. They're growing up. So they won't believe in the invasion. They make fun. Worse than parents, even. I hate them worst. We'll kill them first.
I hope you're saving your father and me for last.
Drill says you're dangerous. Know why?
Why?
'Cause you don't believe the Martians ought to let us kids run the world. But I think they'll let me keep you because I'm helping so much. I'll talk to Drill. Maybe we won't have to kill you.
Mary, I think this nonsense has gone far enough.
Can I go out now, please?
Run along, dear.
Don't Dad. I won't let them hurt you.
Televisor.
Oh, would you please connect me with Mrs. Helen Rogerson on Channel 72Z, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania?
What is your channel, please?
817X, New Rochelle, New York.
Thank you. Just a moment. Go ahead. You can see your party now.
Hi, sis. How are things in New York?
Fine, Helen. How are things in Pittsburgh? Oh, you look tired.
Oh, I've been having a terrible time with the children.
Sick?
No, just underfoot. They've got a new game that's got me just about crazy. It's called Invasion.
Did you say Invasion? Isn't that strange? My Mink is playing it, too.
My boy Tim is all involved with some imaginary fellow named Drill, who's running the Invasion.
Must be a new password. Mink likes him, too.
How do you suppose these games start? My backyard looks like a scrap drive. They've got every conceivable kind of mechanical gadget out there. I talked to Josephine Schiller in Boston, and she says her kids are wild about it, too. It's sweeping the country.
I can't understand it. Helen, do you suppose...
What?
Oh, nothing. Just a wild thought that crossed my mind. Oh, say, the reason I called is that black and white cake recipe...
What was that?
I don't know. One of the children might have hurt himself. I'll have to run and see, dear. Call me back tonight, will you?
All right, Mary. Bye.
Mink? What is it? Who was that who screamed?
Peggy Ann.
What happened?
She got scared and ran home.
Did you hit her?
Nope, she just got scared. She's a scare baby anyway.
Now, Mink, tell me why she screamed.
No, I can't.
Mink, you'll answer me or come inside this instant. I've had enough nonsense.
I can't quit now, Mom. It's almost 0 hours.
Then tell me what frightened Peggy Ann.
Okay, she saw Drill. He almost came through.
Through what?
Those pipes and things we set up. She looked into one of the pipes and screamed. I guess she saw Drill.
And no one hit her?
No, Mom.
Very well, Mink. I'll call Peggy Ann's mother and see how she is.
If we could only get Drill through, it would be easy. Then all the others could come through after him.
I'm going in now, Mink. I'll call you in for your bath in half an hour. Your father and I want to go out tonight.
You won't be able to go out, Mom.
Why not?
0 hours, 5 o'clock, Mom.
Hello, dear.
Oh, you're home early, Henry.
Mm-hmm. Thought I'd relax a little before we went to the theater. Where's the little one?
Out back.
Oh, same game?
Mm-hmm. Same game. They've got a stack of pipes and hammers and spoons a mile high out there.
Oh, my children. Why do we have them?
Well, they are strange creatures, aren't they? Even Mink. She's a part of us, and yet...
Yeah, look, dear, I'd like to discuss this with you, but we do have a theater date, and it's almost 5 o'clock now, so... Say, what's happened to the kids? They're so quiet. Now, when children are quiet, you know there's some mischief. Say, what's that sound?
I don't know.
Those kids aren't playing with anything electrical, are they?
Well, I'm sure they aren't. At least...
Just the same, I'd better go out.
Henry, ask them to put off the invasion.
Lord, what's that? Mary, look out the window.
Henry!
What is it? Where are the children? Mary, why are you shaking? What did you see?
Henry!
Hmm?
Quick, up to the attic.
Well, they aren't in the attic.
Yes, the attic, quick.
No, Mary, come back here. Mary, don't go up. They aren't up there. Mary, are you out of your mind? There's no one up here.
Quick, shut the door. Lock it.
But there's nothing up here. What is wrong with you? Now, Mary, come to your senses.
Henry, we've got to stay here and hide.
What are you talking about?
I saw it through the window. Henry, it was horrible. They weren't making believe. It is an invasion.
Oh, Mary, for heaven's sake, let's get down out of this attic and talk this over sensibly. I want to find out if Mink is all right.
She's all right. I saw her. She was leading them around the corner of the house.
Leading who? The kids?
Shh. Listen.
Well, there's nothing.
Listen. The front door. They're coming.
Good Lord, those kids sound like 50 men with boots on.
No, not men. Oh, please, God, don't let them find us. Don't let them, please, God.
I don't understand this. Who's there?
Don't shout, they'll hear.
Who's down there? I demand that you answer me.
coming. The whole house is shaking.
Who's there? Hush,
please be quiet. They might go away. Henry. Henry.
Mom? Dad? Are you in the attic?
Henry, listen.
That's Mink. It's Mink. We've got to save her.
Henry, don't you understand? She's leading them.
What?
She's leading them. She's on their side, Henry. Oh, please, God, forgive them.
The children on their side?
She told us, but we wouldn't believe her. Shh, listen. They're coming up. Oh, God.
Mom, Dad, we know you're in there. I guess you better melt the lock drill.
Henry? Henry, the lock. It's melting. The door. Oh, dear God.
Mom, Dad? Oh, I see you now. Peek-a-boo!
You have just heard X-1, presented by the National Broadcasting Company, in cooperation with Street and Smith, publishers of Astounding Science Fiction. Tonight, by transcription, X-1 has brought you Zero Hour by Ray Bradbury, as adapted for radio by George Lefferts. Featured in the cast were Nina Reeder, David Pfeffer, Peggy Lubin, Les Damon, Raleigh Bester, Bob Hastings, and John Larkin. X-1 was directed by Daniel Sutter and is an NBC Radio Network production. And now, next week, The Vital Factor by Nelson Bond. The story of a man who sought to rule the universe and then discovered that this formula for gaining that power was minus one precious ingredient. You'll hear it on X-1. It's Groomed for Your Interests, weekday, NBC Radio.